is now in session. Chief Judge Clary, Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Edward J. Clary presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to this special session of the Court of Appeals. The date is August 13, 2019. We have one matter on our oral calendar. It's in the matter of the civil commitment of Ronald Schmidt. Each side will have 15 minutes for argument. The appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We ask that the attorneys identify themselves before they begin their presentation. The appellant may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'm Anthony Noss, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Your Honors, the Commissioner respectfully requests that this court reverse the commitment appeal panel's order granting Ronald Schmidt's petition for provisional discharge and deny his petition for provisional discharge. The standard of review in effect for this case was recently clarified by this court in the Edwards decision, which was discussed in footnote one of the Commissioner's reply. In Edwards, this court held that when it reviews the substantive merits of the panel's decision on a petition for a reduction in custody after a phase two hearing, it reviews such a decision for clear error, examining the record to determine whether the evidence as a whole sustains the panel's findings. Notably, though, Edwards didn't eliminate that this court still reviews or still uses de novo review for purely legal questions, which are in effect here in part.
Your fourth issue changes substantially, though, under Edwards, doesn't it? Your credibility challenge?
Your Honor, I believe the commissioner did acknowledge that it would, that the standard of review perhaps was not argued under a clear error, or the clear error standard, the evidence as a whole standard, in the commissioner's initial brief before the Edwards decision.
Sure.
But the commissioner's argument on the fourth issue does clarify that even under the clear error evidence as a whole standard, the commissioner nonetheless prevails because the credibility finding is such a central finding. It's really the central finding to the panel's overall decision, setting aside all these other legal questions that the commissioner raises, that even under that standard, the commissioner's arguments still prevail.
How does the centrality of the credibility determination alter whether it's a clear error or de novo review, or whether the state can prevail on that question?
I'm entirely sure I'm understanding your question, Your Honor.
Your challenge is to the panel's reliance on Dr. Gilbertson's opinion.
Correct, Your Honor.
So under a clear error review, as opposed to a de novo review, I'm trying to get a sense of how the state can prevail on that issue. I recognize the other three issues are more of a legal question, but that one seems to be almost entirely a weighing of the evidence question. Doesn't it go to the weight of the evidence?
It may appear to go to the weight of the evidence, Your Honor, but the commissioner's argument is that that specific finding was clearly erroneous, and without that finding, the rest of the panel's order just falls apart, and the evidence as a whole does not support the panel's final decision to grant provisional discharge. I guess that's as best as I can try to differentiate it under the differing standards of review.
So it's finding 59 that you're asserting is clearly erroneous? Just the finding that his analysis and opinion was very credible?
Your Honor, I'd have to page through the order at this point. The commissioner would assert that any findings that make comparative credibility determinations or persuasiveness sort of analyses as to Dr. Gilbertson's opinion over that of Dr. Carr are clearly erroneous.
So what we're being asked to do is substitute the commissioner's belief that Dr. Gilbertson was not persuasive and not credible, that the other doctor was?
In effect, by correcting that clearly erroneous finding about Dr. Gilbertson's analysis being more credible, that would, Your Honor, seem to be the practical effect of that.
And what is your argument supporting your contention that that finding, that Dr. Gilbertson's analysis and opinion are very credible, is clearly erroneous?
Your Honor, as I believe the commissioner describes in her initial and reply briefs, it's really primarily that Dr. Gilbertson did not, or he acknowledged in his testimony that he did not have the up-to-date training on the Stable 2007 tool.
Which was one of many risk assessment tools that were testified about by the various experts in the case, correct?
Yeah. There were several tools, Your Honor, yes.
So and there was just the one that he hadn't gotten the updated training on. True?
I believe, Your Honor, but the Stable 2007 is the tool that relates to the dynamic risk analysis here, which is, as borne out by the testimony of Dr. Carr and Dr. Gilbertson, seemingly a lot of what this case focused on.
But the evidence also includes, obviously, Mr. Schmidt's treatment records, his progress, how he was doing in the CPS program for the, I guess, 4 years leading up to the hearing this year. I mean, that's true.
That is, Your Honor.
So you're suggesting that all of Dr. Gilbertson's testimony on all of the other facts that went into his recommendation are clearly erroneous also?
Not necessarily every specific fact or everything that he was reiterating from the records, Your Honor, but what's important here is that, and it goes to the sort of the cornerstone argument that the commissioner made, is that, and I believe the case is Addington v. Texas, is a United States Supreme Court case. And I believe in that case, the Supreme Court discussed how in civil commitment proceedings, it's not just the facts that matter. It's how those facts are essentially viewed through the lens of the experts. So here, this is why the credibility determination and Dr. Gilbertson and Dr. Carr's opinions are so central.
Well, it's clear why it's central. What's not so clear to me is why you believe, why the state believes, that Dr. Gilbertson's testimony is so incredible that we can actually reverse the panel's credibility determination. What's the most persuasive case or the most on-point case you were able to find that you think would apply, that we can rely upon in saying that the panel was so wrong in its credibility assessment that we're going to substitute our judgment of credibility for the panel's?
Your Honor, I do not have a specific case that I can cite where this court has, for example, reversed a credibility determination under facts very similar to
this. What about under any facts? What's the most persuasive case you were able to point us to where we reversed a panel's decision on a credibility determination?
Your Honor, there's not a specific case I can point to at this time.
What about outside the context of civil commitment? Were you able to find any cases where this court reversed a lower court or an administrative review panel's credibility determination?
I don't have one at my fingertips right now, Your Honor. I cannot say that none exist, but I cannot cite one.
I think I know of some that exist, but they're on extraordinary facts where the cases I'm thinking of are cases where a fact finder expressly indicated a basis for a credibility determination on documents, for example, and it was simply an incomprehensible, illogical assessment of those facts. Of the evidence, the documentary evidence. I've never seen where our court has reversed a credibility determination on testimony like this.
Well, Your Honor, if I may try to pivot things here, the court seems interested in this fourth issue, but really, that's not even something that this court, in conducting the overall analysis of the provisional discharge plan, probably even gets to, due to the faulty nature of the provisional discharge in this place.
Which of the other issues do you feel is the strongest for the state?
Well, they all sort of play together, Your Honor, but it's probably the first issue that the commissioner raises, which has to do with the provisional discharge plan.
On that issue, I'm just curious, was that raised to the panel, and do you believe that it was necessary to raise the issue to the panel for us to consider it in reviewing the panel's decision?
Yes, Your Honor, that issue was undoubtedly raised. It was expressly raised below the panel. And I'm sorry, the second question was, Your Honor?
But that just defeats the need to answer the second part of the question. My second question is, if the panel did not review that issue and didn't decide that issue, what would be the basis for us to review it? But your position is that the argument was fully presented to and decided by the panel?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe the panel expressly acknowledged that that argument was made. I think the panel used the term, even said the commissioner's counsel argued that the plan was fundamentally flawed or fundamentally problematic. So the panel itself acknowledged that the commissioner had raised this argument below.
What argument are we talking about specifically? Are we talking about the requirement of the plan to have the board review the panel's decisions?
Yes, Your Honor. It's essentially the after review by the special review board language that was kind of added on to various central provisions in the plan.
And you're saying that in the findings, the panel acknowledged that this argument was made before them?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you direct us to that?
If I may just look for a moment, Your Honor. Your Honor, as at page 18, this is appellant's addendum, page 18, footnote 5, there is a reference to the attorney for the commissioner arguing that the way the plan is drafted is fundamentally problematic.
And that's a quote, it appears to be. The commission, the panel is quoting the state's argument.
That appears to be the case, Your Honor.
Doesn't it reference the fact that the plan includes independent living as an option, and that was the argument asserted on, or that the appeal panel is discussing on page 18?
Yes, Your Honor, it appears that
the appeal panel just said, nope, that's off the table. We don't think that would be an appropriate provision of any discharge plan, correct?
Your Honors, yes, it appears that footnote relates to that argument.
Right.
However, I would assert to this court that the transcript should make crystal clear that this argument was not waived below.
So your position is, obviously the way the panel describes this argument is not the precise way that you're describing it in your brief today to this court. The way the plan is drafted is sort of a generic phraseology. It doesn't refer to your issue number one, the before and after board versus panel assessment. But I gather your position is the record will clearly articulate, will clearly show that this argument was made to the panel.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, as the commissioner pointed out in the reply brief, at a minimum, at the beginning of section one, even the panel recognized that the terms of the plan were, quote, problematic, quote, backwards, and put the cart before the horse.
I guess it's not clear to me that those are the same arguments, that we're talking apples to apples, but if you're representing that it's in the record and we'll be able to find it, we can. Perhaps during your break, when you're listening to your opponent's argument, you can find the place in the record and cite to us during your rebuttal argument.
Yes, Your Honor, I will attempt to do that. I don't want to waste the court's time searching through papers right now.
For your time.
Thank you. So really, In that case, Your Honors, there, for the first issue, there's this critically damaging added language to the after review by the SRB, which effectively prevents the panel from granting his provisional discharge to any specific place.
But doesn't the panel really address that in the order and say, you know, yes, the language is a little odd, but this is the way these things work, and we're saying independent living is off the table, and we're saying these are the type of residential placements that would be appropriate, and we recognize that it's going to be MSOP employees, reintegration specialists, or somebody who is going to actually go out and assist the patient in finding them. I mean, why isn't the appeal panel's treatment of that argument correct?
Your Honor, the panel can't just essentially change the provisional discharge plan. They are bound by statute to only considering terms or conditions that were presented below. The panel did not stay within the confines of the statute.
Well, doesn't the case law suggest that they cannot do that when it's not been presented to the Special Review Board? And wasn't this presented to the board, the idea of independent living?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a range of options presented to the Special Review Board, Your Honor. That was, in effect, changed to a single term. So the commissioner's argument is that this is a fundamentally different term or condition. By that specific term or condition not being presented below and instead a range of options, it's a new term or condition.
But the idea of independent living was presented to the SRB, isn't that correct?
Your Honor, the term was all levels of supervision / staffing from independent living through 24 hours per day supervision.
Right. So there's a range.
There was a range presented to the SRB, Your Honor.
And so we understand that the panel does not have unfettered discretion, but they're narrowing the range. So you're saying that they can't do that?
Correct. The panel created a new term or condition.
Well, did they, or did they just narrow the range?
By picking from part of the range, Your Honor, and only selecting one, it's a fundamentally different term. That's not something that that term alone is not something that the SRB reviewed.
And the state is prejudiced how? Given the fact that the state had the opportunity to respond to the range, including this focus of the where the panel ultimately landed, how is the state prejudiced by the end result?
Your Honor, I could see that being an argument that the commissioner may raise here. It's not an argument that the commissioner is making. The argument, and respectfully, that what's the prejudice here would seem to be.
You're arguing that it just violates the statute, even if the state wasn't harmed.
That's correct, Your Honor. Your Honors, I see my time is up.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Tone. I'm the attorney for respondent Ronald Schmidt. I guess I'll start first by addressing the appellant's fourth argument, kind of the credibility determination. And I think in listening to the court's questions and counsel's argument, much of what I had to say was already discussed. This is a weighing of the evidence issue under Edwards that recently decided clearly erroneous is the appropriate standard of review. I think that the commissioner is just simply asking this court to disregard the panel's weighing of the evidence and replace the panel's credibility determination with its own. I think that when you look at the record as a whole, the panel's findings are clearly supported by the order, or the order is clearly supported by the evidence within the record. The panel did not rely solely on Dr. Gilbertson's credibility. There's a substantial amount of evidence and portions of Mr. Schiffer and Dr. Carr's testimony that also actually support Mr. Schmidt being granted a provisional discharge. With respect to risk assessment, Dr. Gilbertson conducted his own assessment of risk. He reviewed and commented as to prior risk assessments and whether or not he agreed with them or not. And I think that Your Honor hit the nail on the hammer on the nail there when you said that Dr. Gilbertson did not solely rely on one specific tool. He considered all of the tools in totality, and that's how he reached his opinion.
What is your position on the clarity of issue number one before the panel? Was that argument presented to the panel or not?
My recollection of the testimony, so at the end of the phase one hearing, counsel made a motion to dismiss, and I believe he did state something to the effect of, because of this particular language, the conditions and structure necessary by the SCAP panel after review by the special review board. I do believe counsel mentioned that in his closing argument on the motion to dismiss in the phase one hearing. I don't think that the court directly identified it or addressed that issue in its order, but as previously mentioned, within the court's order, the panel's order, the way it framed counsel's arguments and the legal attacks made to the panel's authority and jurisdiction in this case, I think that it effectively dealt with that particular argument.
So you think that's properly in front of us?
I do believe that that semantics argument is properly in front of this court. When you get to the argument that the commissioner made about the MSOP supervision policies, that particular argument I don't think is properly in front of this court. Our position, as briefed, the panel specifically stated that the MSOP supervision policies are read in conjunction with the provisional discharge plan. And I don't think that the panel incorporated the policy into the plan as a term or a condition. And by the commissioner not objecting to that evidence being admitted, I think it did waive that particular argument to this court. This notion that the panel can't eliminate a phrase or a term from a plan, I think, to me, is probably the key issue. When, as the court mentioned, and when you look at that unpublished case cited by the Commissioner Doherty and also CROP, the panel does not have unfettered authority to revise. And I think the key word there is unfettered. And very clearly from the statute and the case law, the panel cannot add terms and conditions to a plan. There's no authority that I was able to find that says the panel can't eliminate or select from a range of options within the plan. The plan, as was presented to the panel, is the same plan that was presented to the special review board.
Just so I make sure I understand the record, this is the plan that your client signed September 26, 2017.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. It was admitted as Exhibit 101. Yes, September 26, 2018.
And so that's the same plan that Mr. Schmidt submitted back to the SRB and to judicial appeal.
Correct. Same plan, both places. Correct. And I think, like I said, I was unable to find any authority that says a plan, that the panel does not have the ability to revise, meaning eliminate a plan. Very clearly, they cannot add to it. But when you look at the language of CROP and Doherty, when it says does not have unfettered authority, clearly that means the panel has some authority. And,
well,
you know, I referenced...
We won't rely upon the case if the case is not consistent with the statute.
Though. Certainly, certainly. But I think
the statute drives our answer to
absolutely
this question, not the case.
Absolutely, I agree. But I think that the case is in line with the statute. It is quite clear the panel cannot add. The statute does not say anything about elimination. And I think those are two separate things. And to eliminate a phrase or a term from a condition does not create a brand new condition within the plan. The exact same language was presented to the SRB as it was to the panel, and I think that comports with the statute and what was necessary.
So it looks like under the statute, we have to decide whether, as a matter of law, a range of conditions is itself a condition. The language I think that is going to guide the decision is a judicial appeal panel from Subdivision 3 may not grant a transfer or provisional discharge on terms or conditions that were not presented to the special review board.
Correct.
And I gather the argument is that if a range of terms are presented or is presented, then there can't be a choice from among those, from among that range. That for the range itself would have to be the term, I think, semantically.
You know, I'm not necessarily sure it has to be that way. I think that there's nothing, again, there's nothing, no authority, statute, case law, rule that says a petitioner, in this case, Mr. Schmidt, cannot present a range of options. There's nothing that prohibits that. If you look at the Kirchhoff series of Court of Appeals cases that came out this year, a similar argument was raised. And I have that citation. In re Civil Commitment of Kirchhoff, the first one came out in January of 2019. That's A18-1191. The second one came out in July, A19-0378. The same argument was made about this condition that contains the range of options from independent living to supervised living. In that case, the panel determined that provisional discharge was appropriate. And in that second Kirchhoff Court of Appeals decision, the Court of Appeals upheld the panel's granting of that provisional discharge. It was not fatal in that case. And I, again, was not
convinced that particular issue was not directly raised in that case.
It was discussed. It was not certainly the central issue of the case. It was raised in the first appeal and not raised in the second appeal. But that was the closest case I could find where this issue in part is addressed or at least mentioned in a decision. I think that in these types of cases, because of the specialized area, the panel has to have the authority to do what it needs to do. And I kind of made the analogy on this range of options to the Civil Rules of Procedure alternate pleadings. In litigation, you don't always know what you have when you start the case. You have to work through the litigation to narrow your claims and your theory of the case. And I think the same type of argument makes sense and is applicable to presenting a range of options within a provisional discharge plan. And I think that if you know, with the overlay between the Civil Rules of Procedure and the Commitment Act, when you also look at the comment to Rule 1 of the Civil Rules of Procedure, the goal of litigation is just speedy and inexpensive resolution of cases. When you present a range of options, you know, this case took 2 years approximately from the filing of the SRB petition to get to the panel's decision. Requiring a petitioner in Mr. Schmidt's case to go back and strike one option doesn't make sense when you're considering the fundamental liberty issues at stake and just the whole statutory scheme and how the process works. I think that Mr. Schmidt's argument is really quite straightforward. The issues have been briefed. Nothing unusual or surprising about this case. This is the commissioner upset that the commissioner lost, and the commissioner is grasping at an attempt to get this court to read in restrictions on the panel's authority that aren't otherwise available.
Now, in our first Kirchhoff case, we did remand the case because of a lack of a credibility determination where the panel relied upon an opinion that wasn't given, where there was seemingly no support for the decision, and we remanded it. Why isn't the credibility question here essentially that, since there's no clear articulation of the bases?
I think that the panel did make a clear articulation of the basis for its decision. It went through the testimony from each of the witnesses. It discussed what it found credible, or persuasive, whose testimony it didn't, and it offered additional opinions as to the portions of that testimony the court found credible. So it wasn't a wholesale, I'm rejecting everything Dr. Carr has to say and accepting everything Dr. Gilbertson has to say. I think it was particularized in this case. And so I don't think it's simply the court saying, we like Dr. Gilbertson, we didn't like the other witnesses. I think that this order was sufficiently particularized. And fundamentally, as mentioned in that second Kirchhoff case, it's a legal determination to be made by the panel. The panel very clearly spelled out the factors and the reasons why it decided what it decided. If the court doesn't have any additional questions.
No, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Noss, any rebuttal?
Your Honors, following up on the inquiry from the court about the first issue in the commissioner's brief, I believe if the panel, or if this court were to refer to page 76 of the phase one hearing, at a minimum, page 141 of the Phase 2 hearing, the court would be satisfied that the first issue was argued below, and it sounds like Mr. Schmidt is not contesting that it was not.
Sounds like a concession, anyway. Thank you.
Your Honors, secondly, as to the, there was a waiver argument about the policies. The commissioner addresses that waiver argument and rebuts it at footnote 9 of her reply. I won't repeat those arguments now. Your Honors, as to, there was a lot of talk in Mr. Schmidt's argument about one of the secondary issues here, which is this narrowing of terms sort of thing. Can the panel do that? The commissioner implores the court to not lose sight of how critical the first issue is. Here, there was some reference to the crop decision, I believe, by Mr. Schmidt's counsel, and some sort of argument that, well, if parties aren't allowed to just put some all sorts of open-ended things in their plans, then how is the panel ever supposed to practically operate? Well, this court has addressed that issue in part in its crop decision. In crop, the PD plan referred to this is page 651 of the crop decision from this court in 2017. The plan there said that Mr. Crop, quote, will reside at a residential location that has been approved by the MSOP executive director as being suitable for Mr. Crop's housing needs and provides reasonable protection for local community and general public safety. If Mr. Schmidt wanted to have a plan that he knew would pass muster on appellate review at this court, he could have just used the term that this court approved in crop. But instead, he chose to...
You mean the uncertain term of saying go back and let the MSOP executive director find a place? How is this functionally different? I know the language is a little odd, but wasn't it reasonable for the commitment appeal panel to read those provisions, in term 7 and other places throughout this provisional discharge plan that Mr. Schmidt submitted to, in fact, give back to MSOP the ability to finalize the thing?
Your Honor,
how is this different than crop?
Your Honor, the critical difference here is that comma after review by the special review board language that's present in Mr. Schmidt's provisional discharge plan. That's the plain language of the plan. It appears that Your Honor may be perhaps hinting to something akin to statutory construction or contract interpretation, but here the plan isn't ambiguous. We have the plain language of the plan that has the after review by the special review board language that was not included in that quotation from the crop provisional discharge plan. So it's fundamentally different than the crop case.
Counsel, I want to go back for a minute because this is going to bother me throughout reading this file. Part of the argument of your client is that the plan is defective because it includes the possibility of independent living. That's part of your argument. It includes the possibility of independent living, correct? I mean, it seems to me that was part of the objection. So let me just move on here. The panel eliminates that, and your client's response is you can't do that, even though that's really the primary objection to the plan. It seems strange to me. It seems circular. Can you explain that?
The primary argument, Your Honor, is that the panel considered a term or condition that wasn't presented below.
Well, again, they don't have unfettered discretion, which I agree with the Respondents' Counsel means they have some discretion, but go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, the statute provides the authority for the panel here. The statute says that the panel can't grant a provisional discharge on terms or conditions that weren't presented below. The commissioners...
They weren't presented below, correct, yes.
So the commissioner's argument is not that this is a matter of looking at discretion, it's just looking at the statutory language and that the panel has gone beyond its authority.
Yes, but from reading this, it seems to me that their primary focus, once they get past that argument, is on the possibility of independent living. They didn't like that, correct? Commissioner didn't like that.
Your Honor, I don't believe any of the experts liked the independent living option, and nor did the judicial or the commitment appeal panel.
But that gets back to my original question to you before you sat down, which was, which I think is what the Chief Judge is asking you about. The position of the state was to object to a particular term. Once that's removed from the table, the fallback argument seems to be that now that there is a change, the way that you would describe it, between what the board considered and the panel considered, now you've violated the statute, even though there's no prejudice to the state because the state sort of got what it, or at least the objection was sort of given given merit by the panel. So your position seems to be that even if, in the end, the state is not prejudiced, the statute was not met, and that really is the thrust of your argument. Is that correct or not correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The error here by the panel was going beyond
Let me press that a little bit. I know you're out of time, but if I could ask one more question. And this is my hang-up with your argument, and you can take a shot at disabusing me of my concern. The statute says the judicial appeal panel may not grant a transfer or provisional discharge on terms or conditions that were not presented to the special review board. It seems to me that if the legislature wanted to say what you are suggesting that this statute says, then it could have said so expressly, which I think what you're asking us to do is to interpret that provision to say that the panel can't grant a transfer or discharge except by adopting the exact plan considered by the board. That's essentially what you're asking us to do, to read into this statute, aren't you?
In part, Your Honor, but I think there's also another argument that the panel actually created a new term or condition.
By the way that they describe the, when you say created a new term or condition by choosing from among the options that were presented, that was creating a new term?
If I may refer to a quote from the order. Well, the plan, Your Honor, said all levels of supervision / staffing from independent living through 24 hours per day supervision for residents. And this became, in the panel's order, a structured and supervised residence.
Okay, Counselor, we're out of time. Do you have any further
questions? Nope, that answers my question.
Thank you. Thank you both. The matter is taken under advisement. An opinion will issue within 90 days, and we are adjourned.
All rise.